You're Within the Realm, and I'm Steve Garrett. It was the summer of 1969. The biggest news of that summer was the moon landing, with Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, and our favorite, Buzz Aldrin, finally walking on the moon. The sounds coming out of the radio in my parents' car included Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town by a then-unknown Kenny Rogers in the first edition, and A Boy Named Sue by Johnny Cash. The child-rearing manual in our neck of the woods was equal parts Dr. Spock and this song. Also in that summer, several carloads of kids from my hometown had been driven to the city of Salisaw, Oklahoma. We were at the depot to catch the train, one of the last passenger trains on the Kansas City Southern Line. I was 5 years old, probably towards the lower end of the age range of this group of kids. But the idea was to allow us to ride the train from Salisaw, about 30 miles north to our hometown of Stillwell, just to say that we rode the train. It was just another thing that was going the way of the dodo, and our parents wanted us to be able to say that we rode the train. I remember parts of the trip vividly. I cannot recall seeing the Ozark scenery rush by the window to my left. No, I remember something else. I remember the interior of the rail car. I remember visiting with the porter in his brilliant white jacket, the whitest cloth I'd ever seen in my life. He spoke with my brother and me, well, long enough to make an impression. I'm sure he was wondering what this passel of kids was doing on his train. I recall the brass foot rails, all the things a five-year-old might really remember. I do remember that we got a beverage on the trip. The porter, I spoke about earlier, brought us a Coke in a small Dixie cup. Pretty exciting stuff. Later in that year of 1969, in November, the Southern Belle, the sweetheart of American trains, the last passenger line, ran through our hometown of Stillwell. The local depot was closed, and it really was a significant point in history for our hometown. Stillwell, Oklahoma, owed its existence to the railroad. Before 1895, the center for commerce in the Flint District of the Cherokee Nation was the town of Mays. This was the location of the Flint District Courthouse. The proposed railroad line missed the town of Mays by several miles. Not to miss out on a great opportunity, the businesses picked up, moved over the hill to where the rail line was coming through. One of those businesses was owned by the Fletcher family, and Fletcher Hardware is the longest-running business in the city of Stillwell. The railroad itself owed its existence to a man by the name of Arthur Stillwell. Arthur Stillwell was born in New York State, and he was a traveling salesman. He married, and he and his new wife moved west. He worked for Travelers Insurance in Chicago, and with his earnings from the insurance business, he moved further west to Kansas City and started into railroad building. His first venture was the Kansas City Suburban Belt Railway, which eventually connected the Argentine District in Kansas City, Kansas, to Independence, Missouri. As was the practice in those days, Stillwell built Fairmont Park, somewhere between Kansas City and Independence. This was an amusement and athletic park built to encourage people to ride the rails out to it. It came complete with a 6-hole golf course. But he had bigger ambitions. He dreamed of connecting Kansas City to the Gulf of Mexico. He began acquiring existing rail lines and building new, and formed the Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Gulf Railroad. Instead of connecting at an existing port at the Gulf of Mexico, he opted to build a new port, named for himself, Port Arthur, Texas. Much of the line through Arkansas was funded by Dutch investors. Two of the cities established along the new line, DeQueen, Arkansas, and Mena, Arkansas, were named in honor of the Dutch investors. In all, over 40 cities were established along the railroad. Three of them bear his name: Port Arthur, Texas, the city of Stillwell, Oklahoma, and Stillwell, Kansas. The line between Kansas City and Port Arthur was completed in 1900, just in time for one of his investors to force him from his presidency of the company. Undaunted, Arthur Stillwell began another enterprise. This go-around, he saw Kansas City connected to the Pacific Ocean. The name of this ambitious project was the Kansas City, Mexico, and Orient Railroad. Just as the Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Gulf Railroad had its share of problems, including a yellow fever outbreak and a hurricane, the Kansas City, Mexico, and Orient Line had its share of problems. These include the destruction by fire of the primary shops in Fairview, Oklahoma, and the Mexican Revolution. By the early 19-teens, the Endeavor went bankrupt and found itself under the receivership of William Kemper, a Kansas City financier. Oil was discovered beneath the tracks of the railroad and added to the fortune of the Kemper family. With this reversal, the Stillwells moved back to New York, where he took up writing, and he wrote plays and poetry, hymns, and the occasional political book. They lived modestly in a New York apartment until his death in 1928. 13 days later, his distraught wife threw herself out of the apartment window to her own death. Although he had built a railroad empire, his net worth was around $1,000 at his death, and he and his wife's cremated remains have not been located. But the railroad flourished. An oil find in East Texas helped make the railroad profitable, and the Port of Arthur as well. In 1967, the federal government ceased using railroads as a carrier for the mail. This contract had made it possible to continue passenger service. In the 1960s, the Kansas City Southern, which the rail line had become, ran two passenger trains. But by the time that group of kids gathered in Salisaw, only one was still running, the Southern Belle. By the time of our trip, the Pullman cars and the sleeper cars had been replaced by refurbished observation cars from New York City. It was one of these refurbished cars that had made such a big impression upon me, with its wood and brass and porter and a Coke and a Dixie cup. One of the little observation cars, like the one that I rode in, is said to be preserved in Jackson, Louisiana. Some of the other cars used by the Kansas City Southern on its passenger trains are still in use in North Carolina on the Piedmont Rail Line. I have yet to take another commercial railroad trip since that day in 1969. So the adults were right. I did need to take that trip so that I could say that I rode the train. The coming of the railroads helped bring about an end to the town of Mays, and really to the Cherokee Nation itself. In the space age, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin helped usher in a time when airplanes replaced the railroad as the quickest way to get from point A to point B. But the railroad remains, a testament to the vision of Arthur Stillwell, whose vision included connecting Kansas City to the Gulf of Mexico and creating a new port city where one had not been before. Some called him crazy, but he was able to make his vision a reality. Where he got that vision was surprising and will be the subject of a story on a later episode. So until then, thank you, Arthur Stillwell, for making possible my one ride on the rails. It's 1903 in the oil patch of Cowley County, Kansas, just outside of Dexter. There's a crew drilling for natural gas, and the drillers hit something. But what they've hit creates a geyser. They were drilling for natural gas, but this stuff that they found just wouldn't light. It wouldn't burn. A sample was taken and sent to the University of Kansas in Lawrence to find out exactly what had been found. The results were surprising. In addition to some very common elements, nitrogen and methane, the drilling crew had found the first significant source of an element that had only been discovered in theory 35 years previous. In 1868, observers had found a bright yellow line in the spectrum of the chromosphere of the sun during an eclipse. They determined that this must be a new element that they named after the Greek Titan Helios. Other than this bright line, and a notion by the scientists, there was no tangible evidence of helium. In the years that followed, scientists in Scotland and Sweden were able to find small amounts of the element to use in experiments. It wasn't until the 1903 strike that a significant amount of helium was found. In the few years that followed, it was determined that helium could be extracted as a byproduct of natural gas drilling. Although it is the second most common found element in the universe, it is rare on Earth. It also comes up short in the top mark in another category. It is only the second lightest element, hydrogen being the lightest. Helium is tasteless, odorless, non-toxic, despite what your Aunt Beulah told you when you were 12 when you were sucking down helium out of a balloon to make a funny voice, and not as volatile as its cousin, hydrogen, which will come into play later. Once it was determined that this rare element could be extracted and separated for use, a use had to be found. There was no practical application for it at the time. The discovery and development of helium coincided with great interest in lighter-than-air airships, like blimps and zeppelins. By 1917, the U.S. military was researching the use of helium for airships. They found a limited use for it in World War I, but did not find a significant use until 1921, when the Navy developed the first helium-filled airship, the C-7, that made a test flight from Hampton Roads, Virginia to Washington, D.C. 2 years later, a rigid helium-filled airship, called the USS Shenandoah, was developed and used extensively through the 1920s. Nearly the entire world reserve of helium was used to fill the tanks of the Shenandoah. The United States had a monopoly on helium production. In 1925, Congress passed the Helium Act, which established the National Helium Reserve near Amarillo. Because of the United States' monopoly on helium, European airship developers had to use hydrogen as the lifting agent for their ships. Hydrogen is lighter than helium, but more dangerous, as demonstrated by the Hindenburg disaster in 1938. After World War II, lighter-than-air airships fell out of favor. At that point, most of America's helium, now in liquid form, was used as a coolant for NASA's rockets. Although other countries have developed helium extraction programs, the bulk of the world's helium still comes from the United States, and the National Helium Reserve is still in use in Amarillo. But it's worth remembering that just a little over 100 years ago, helium from beneath the Great Plains of the United States and Little Dexter, Kansas, allowed for us to dream about lighter-than-air airships and helped us to get into space. Thanks for stopping by the podcast today. If you want to keep up with us, you can do so by going to our Facebook page, Within the Realm, or stopping by our website, withinpodcast.com. While you're there, be sure to like and share. We'll have some photographs associated with the stories presented on the podcast today on the Facebook page. The theme music was provided by 556 and a half. Other music was provided by Spring Eyes. And as always, thanks for listening.